Hello and welcome. You're listening to Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism. Coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. My name is Peter Frey. I'm the co-director of the Centre for Media Transition at UTS, and my producer today is Anthony Dockrell. Coming up, it's been a monumental week in the media. Firstly, with the lifting of the suppression order on Tuesday morning, allowing the media to tell the country that something that journos have known privately since December, that being that Cardinal Pell was found guilty on child sex charges. And of course, you may have known it yourself, because if you had read overseas websites like the Wash Post and the Daily Beast, and probably even your own Twitter stream back then, you would have got the news. So tonight we're going to discuss the media's coverage of Pell's conviction, the suppression order, and the threats by the court to take action over local news outlets who referred to the conviction in December without actually naming Pell. So from a four-letter word to a three-letter one, ITA. News this week that the ABC's board will have a new chair, and her name will be Ida Buttrose. And that wasn't a name on anyone else's radar, and it certainly wasn't a name that was put forward by the selection process. So is ITA a wise choice, or is the government still messing with the ABC and its processes? It's a kind of tricky time to be a journalist at the moment, but it seems to be a brilliant time to be a defamation lawyer. And for the couple of guests we have who used to be lawyers, it's not too late. Anyway, it's a tricky time to be a journalist at the moment, but yes, as I say, it's a good time to be a defamation lawyer. Tonight we ask, is defamation law impacting too much on the media's role to hold the powerful to account? All that, plus the breaking news story about an unnamed journalist at The Age who has successfully claimed in court that covering crime and court reporting gave her PTSD. To help us make sense of all this, we have a glorious panel. We have Margot Seville, who is a journalist with an extensive career in the likes of The Australian and Channel 9, a bit of time at the ABC, the Sydney Morning Herald, and she currently freelances, and you can read her work at Crikey. Hello, Margot.
Hello, Peter.
And we have Deirdre Macken, a journalist, a columnist, a witty columnist, very rare breed, the witty columnist, for The Australian at the weekend. And she's been a senior writer for the Sydney Morning Herald, The Good Weekend, the AFR.
The Age.
And The Age. Anything else?
That'll do.
Okay. Hello, Deirdre.
Hello.
Matt Peacock, who is a journalist with a long and distinguished career at the ABC. He's also been the staff-elected director of the ABC board. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Peter.
And Anne Davies. What can I say about you, Anne Davies? Walkley Award winner, investigative journalist, Washington correspondent for the Fairfax, and now works for The Guardian. And was a lawyer.
Yes.
Indeed. So we have two lawyers. We have yourself. Mm-hmm. And Margot, you were a lawyer for a little while, weren't you?
Only 1 year.
Yeah. 1 year. One glorious year. So you don't regret being a journalist?
No.
You sure? You sure? Okay. This week, we were allowed to tell everybody that the world's third most senior Catholic and the most senior Catholic cleric in Australia was found guilty of child sex charges back in December. Now, if you've any been in anywhere near a courtroom or on social media, you will know that there's been an outpouring of anger and emotion that had been held in check with the suppression order. That order was deemed necessary because Pell was facing a second trial on similar abuse charges. Those charges were dropped yesterday, and hence the suppression order was lifted. So tonight we look at the media coverage of the guilty verdict and ask, was the suppression order necessarily in the modern age? And before we turn to how journalists have been stopped from reporting on this story, let's turn to yesterday. By the nature of the suppression order, everyone in the media that needed to know that Pell had been found guilty had time to prepare. This also means that when we look at how the media covered the news on Tuesday, this wasn't a normal breaking news story. So just generally, initially, what was your take on the coverage? Deirdre, let's start with you. There was a lot of it.
The coverage since it's been lifted.
The last few days.
My impression by this morning was it was overkill. But then the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, this has such long ramifications, and not just for child abuse survivors, and not just for Pell. It's got ramifications for anyone who goes to church every Sunday, anyone who's ever been to church on Sunday, anyone who works in Catholic organisations. What are they all thinking? I think they've had their trust and indeed probably their faith undermined by this whole process. So the more, and it's happened at the time when the Vatican has just looked at it and
Well, the timing's incredible. Yeah, the summit in the Vatican.
That's right. So it couldn't have come at a more timely moment. And the fact that it was such a an unlikely case to get up, according to all the lawyers, and yet it's undone the third most senior man in the church. Mm. It's got sort of...
It's a remarkable story.
It really is. So I don't think it's been overdone now.
Okay. Let's turn to some of the more specific pieces. And let's one on Twitter that was getting a lot of coverage was David Marr's piece in The Guardian, which was a withering takedown. As we would probably all appreciate, has been waiting a long time to write that. And in particular, the final paragraph, which I will quote, "The world can now know that a little over 20 years ago, in Pell's first months as an Archbishop of Melbourne, this scourge of sex was forcing choir boys to suck his penis." Was that one of his finest works, or a little bit too much? What do you think?
Well, this is an interesting question, and one that's being debated internally at The Guardian. Personally, I thought it was a fitting end to what was a very hard column and a forensic column that looked at all the things that Pell had said about sexual behaviour and sexual norms in this country. And he has been, as people have pointed out, a warrior for a right-wing view from the church. So, I think it was a tough piece, but it was fair in my view.
Margot, what do you think?
I thought it was entirely appropriate. I think that if you read so much legal coverage, you know, there's so much obfuscation and euphemism around what happens in these types of cases, and the legalese can kind of overtake normal patterns of speech. And I think it's good for people to know exactly what the crime was, especially in cases of child sexual abuse. Most of us are inclined to turn our eyes away from it and try not to think about what actually happens. And David brought it home. I thought it was really good.
And in fact, you yourself had a little Twitter moment by painting a picture for us of someone kissing Colonel Pell's ring in the backstage of the ABC. And that got a lot of Twitter feed as well. Never, so you piled on as well, Margot.
Never drink and tweet after dinner. But
there's a lesson.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, that, seeing those men like that who profess to be chaste and profess to hate homosexuality and who fight against it with every fibre of their being, to see them as these sexual predators and to know what they do, I think that's really vitally important.
Okay. Not all sections of the media reacted like David Marr. I mean, some sections were completely the opposite in a way. Some of Pell's staunchest defenders continued to stick with him. Andrew Bolt, Miranda Devine being the most prominent, but not just those two. It was quite a lot of commentary in Sky along that line, The Telegraph, The Herald Sun, and even the New York Post, a long way away in New York, had a piece yesterday saying that it was basically in defense of Pell. I'm not sure about this, but because there was a lot of different types of commentary. But do you think, Deirdre, that we should read anything in that? I saw this pushback coming a bit from News Limited.
I think it'd be wrong of anyone to say that the jury or, you know, the court process got it wrong. Like that's the part that shouldn't be up for debate amongst us or anyone else. What can be debated is the reaction to it, is the lead up to it, is the ramifications. But I don't think anyone in their right mind can say, well, they got it wrong because they weren't in court. They didn't see the evidence.
Bolt said they got it wrong, but anyway.
Well, yeah, I just don't think that's a debating point.
It's not a debating point. No. Yeah, okay. And maybe, you know, I don't know. What do you think, Anne?
Well, you know, this is our system. Yeah. We hand the decision-making to 12 people and that's how we come up with whether someone's guilty or innocent. And then people can appeal. So the only people who can challenge the process that where the jury was directed, etc., is going to be the Court of Appeal, and no doubt there will be an appeal. So people make mistakes, but this is our best effort at having a system where we get people to judge who's guilty and innocent. And what's the other alternative? We could have had a judge.
Oh, well, we'll get to judges in a second. Yes, indeed. Just as a passing question, really, on the way out of this one, but is it I get the impression sometimes that News Limited is a very Catholic kind of... I mean, I don't know. I don't want to be too sectarian about this.
Well, Richard Eklund does call it the Catholic Boys Weekly.
Yeah. But is that a justified... I mean, that's just another way of criticising, if you like, the right of the media rather than the left, isn't it? Or not? Is there a sectarian divide in Australian media, do you think?
Well, I'm a sort of strong believer in free speech. Mm. And I feel as a principle, we have to allow the free speech of the people we disagree with. And I disagree with everything that they wrote about Pell and everything that they write about most things, actually. But, you know, they've got the right to make their point. And if we go around closing down media organisations we don't agree with, then we're left with, I don't know, the Philippines.
Yeah. Or Hungary or...
Yes.
Yes, whatever. Yeah. Okay, let's turn to the legal issues that come out of this, the suppression order. So the Australian Law Council has called for a review into how suppression orders in this country work. What do you think, Mar? Stay with you. Does the panel do you think that the suppression order worked and should have been used here? Because it kind of didn't really work, did it?
Well, I sort of look at it in two parts. One, there's the principle of the suppression order, which mm-hmm. I think is correct. And, you know, I think if any one of us was charged with a crime, you would want to know that principles of open justice applied to you and that you were able to be judged by a jury who hadn't been prejudiced by earlier hearings against you. So I think, you know, if we want it to apply to us, we have to allow that it applies to Pell and anybody else. So that's the principle, and I think that should be upheld. Mm-hmm. But in practice, I think it's absolutely impossible and ludicrous for the judge to go around threatening to charge people when, you know, with a click on Twitter, anybody could have read that in December.
So in the internet age, this concept of a suppression order, that this kind of knowledge could be contained, has been proved to be a rather fanciful notion, right, Deirdre?
Yeah, and also, as one of the commentators pointed out, if you suppress the established or old media in Australia and let it go viral on the digital media, then perhaps you're not getting the sort of coverage that, that you'd want. It'll be... What is fake news or, you know?
We don't utter those words in this studio.
But it'll be reported with perhaps less rigour than it would have if you'd allowed Australian journalists to do it in their media.
So I guess the question then is two things. One, what's the alternative? Because, I mean, we're all right on the same, you know, Powell or anyone, could be us, we have a right to a fair trial, not to prejudice the prejudice the jury against us. So there is a need for some form of control, but at the same time, this isn't working. So is there an alternative? And secondly, and these letters that have gone out from the court to the Herald Sun and other places, and the Guardian reported it very well yesterday, I mean, is that... where are we getting to with that? I mean, for a start, what are they going to do? I mean, so the Herald Sun ran a headline saying, censor, there's a prominent Australian who's been found guilty. There's a lot of prominent Australians out there. What do you think about all that? What is the alternative to this? Is there an alternative?
Okay, so the underlying principle is, you know, convictions, prior convictions, are really prejudicial when you're facing trial. And that's what this would have amounted to if we'd published that he'd been convicted. Mm. So there is a really... big principle at stake. But what are the alternatives? One is you hear all the trials together and you do it all at once. Now, the courts didn't do that. And that's another principle that applies, that people can choose to have, defendants can choose to have their trials split. So that was one way around it. What else could they have done? They could, in New South Wales, they could have had a judge alone trial for the second trial, on the basis that the judges will be able to separate in their minds the earlier trial from the current trial, unlike jurors. But it's going to be a problem over and over with the internet. I mean, it's just people are going to know what happened. So I think before the courts start throwing the book at the media, maybe they need to think about what are the alternative structures that the court can come up with. Now, having said that, judge alone trial, I kept thinking of a very British scandal where the judge at the end gave, there was a jury in that case, but he gave such biased directions that the politician was acquitted. And I thought, well, maybe that would undermine the confidence in the system if you had a judge judging an archbishop. So, you know, that's just the countervailing.
So what you're saying is nothing's perfect.
Nothing's perfect, but I think we're going to have to look at how the courts handle this, because it's a problem that won't go away. Yeah. You know, there will be leaks all the time around the global media network.
Yeah, and it does seem to be a legal problem. It's not a media problem. And the fact that they've launched all those proceedings against the media is a bit tough, I think, because...
Well, it's a media problem now.
Well, they've made it a media problem, but... Yeah. I think that's a real stretch what they've done there, including some journalists who didn't have any part in it. Mm. It seems like a scattergun approach, and it's going to consume yet more money from, you know, the beleaguered media companies to defend.
Well, yes, we'll get to defamation in a second. But, I mean, the judge was, Margot, the judge was clearly livid at the media for what happened back in December. And this is a very, you know, there seems to be a payback time.
Yeah, it does seem to be payback. Yes, the question is it going to work? Is it going to be effective? Is it going to change the way people cover trials? Not in the least.
Hmm. So what do you think of Anne's idea that, you know, maybe, you know, you have the jury trial on trial one and then you have a judge only on trial two? That might be an option.
Well, that's kind of been part of the Jeffrey Rush case, hasn't it? Mm. The fact that it's a judge standing alone, and he's already said that he's not going to include extra evidence that was offered up by the defence because he didn't feel... So, you know, that's always going to be an issue with a judge alone as well. Yep, I don't know. I guess the courts are so bogged down at the moment, anything that streamlines a case and saves the public money would potentially be a good idea.
Okay.
But if the principle is you don't want the jury to know what's before the court...
You don't have a jury.
Then you don't have a jury, or you hear it all at once with one jury and you deal with it that way. Mm. You know, maybe the courts have to adapt a little bit.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. They're living in the internet age too, right?
Mm,
yeah.
Yes.
All right, we're going to get to defamation in a second. Let's talk about the ABC. Let's talk about the new chairperson of the board, Ida Buttrose. You were surprised?
I think probably I was as surprised as everybody else. One thing I wasn't entirely surprised about is the fact that the nomination panel that's supposed to choose the candidates for chair was completely ignored, as more or less it has been historically since its inception, really. But
why is that? I mean, why have a selection panel?
The system doesn't work.
Okay, system doesn't work. But this is crazy, right? So you have this a panel that puts forward four blokes, doesn't even think about Ida Buttrose, who pops out of nowhere and gets the prize.
That's right. And the last time, of course, they probably wouldn't have thought about Justin Milne unless the minister had rung him up and said, hey, why don't you apply? So it's all a bit, you know, of a joke. And of course, then there's this question of consultation with the leader of the opposition, the ABC being an important publicly owned institution. We all own it. We all have a stake in it. Mm-hmm. And it should be removed from party political pressures, I think, over things like the appointment of chair, and yet this consultation is, what is it? Is it a quick text? Is it a phone call?
So your point is a lot of these processes are a bit of a joke.
Yeah.
So what, we'll go to...
So anyway, in comes Ida.
Well, we can talk about Ida in a minute, because there's a lot to say about Ida, but let's talk about the process just for a little bit longer. What needs to happen?
Well, I think I'd be interested to hear what others say about this, but certainly I think that we need to have a process of selection of the chair and also members of the board that has various criteria attached to it, one of which, of course, importantly, is a knowledge of public media, public broadcasting, for want of a better word, and also... you know, a proven track record of being able to stand up to political pressure and some dedication to the concept of independence and free and fearless media. So all of those criteria, I think, are part and parcel of...
But they're not explicit in the process now.
No, they're not even mentioned, really.
Yeah, okay.
And it needs to be a collaborative process. I mean, why shouldn't the Australian public have more of a say in this process? Or certainly... it be more transparent and up for grabs more.
Ida for president.
Well, you know, there needs to be much more engagement about the process. It needs to be removed from... Mm. I mean, it's easy to say it needs to be removed from party politics, but look at party politics now and, you know, you would want it to be removed,
from
wouldn't
party
you?
Politics.
And so would most normal people.
Okay. All right. Interesting. Well, let's open. Margot, what do you think of ITA? While we're on, let's talk about the person. I know, rather than the process.
I've never met ITA, but she's got an amazing track record in media, and she's certainly run and been the chair and been board members of many, many organisations, with both public and private. So I think a large part of being the chairman is process.
Mm-hmm.
She'll be across that, about the process of running a board. The issue, I think, for me is that board, and particularly the chair, will get to choose the next MD. Mm. And, you know, at a time where I think, you know, I mean, obviously we're not in the caretaker period, but we're so close to an election, I think it's outrageous for the government to make an appointment like that and not to leave it to the next government.
Mm. Yeah, well, that's a good point. Mm. And we will get a new MD of the ABC before the election, I would think.
Probably.
Well, the job is advertised now. Yeah.
And in a way, the MD's job is probably more important in terms of shaping what you see and hear on the ABC. Mm. That person is the front line to standing up to pressure from the government. You know, that's where the calls come.
Mm-hmm.
The chairman has a role, which is to advocate for the ABC and, you know, arguably back up their MD. And they're also responsible for enforcing the charter. Now, the charter is a really important document. It's not, the chairman of the ABC is not the same as the chairman of a normal board.
Mm.
They're not answerable to the shareholder, because the shareholder is the government. They actually have interposed in that this charter, which is incredibly broad, and you need someone with real strength and backbone to push back against all the pressure that will come from the government.
So is Ida that person, Deirdre?
I think she might surprise.
Yeah, I think she probably will.
But right? Just going back to the process, yeah. I sort of thought that Scott Morrison might appoint Tina Arena, as he was so keen to get her number from Julie Bishop.
But well, maybe she'll be next. Maybe. Next one. Yeah.
But if it is a captain's call, there aren't terribly many good examples of captain call. But on one level, I think Ita's a refreshing choice, because older women generally don't get a chance to get into positions of power, and that sends a powerful message. My main concern, and this may sound a bit ageist, but I think it applies to any director or chairman in Australia at the moment, is how across the digital landscape she is, because she does come from a strong media background, but it's an old media background. And the ABC, like every other organisation in Australia, needs to cope with digital disruption and the new generations who are moving through with a completely different mindset and usability of media. So my main concern is how across will she be of that, because she's not a native to the digital landscape. And like most board directors of that age, and a lot of them are that age, a lot of them struggle with technology, not just, you know, calling up an Uber, but understanding how it plays out in their industry.
So, Matt, going back to you on that, because Dave Anderson, the current acting manager, is a very techie type of guy. In fact, the criticism of Dave would be he's not an editorial sort of guy.
Yeah, well, you know, so is Michelle Guthrie with her qualifications, one would say. But and so was Justin Milne with his
obsession
techie
about
qualifications. So I think the more important criteria here, I mean, really, if you look at some of the criteria for a managing director, for example, you'd have to say, I have major criticisms of Mark Scott. But a lot of people don't share those criticisms. Many of the faults that Michelle Guthrie was attacked for were things well underway under Mark Scott.
Mm.
The difference with Mark Scott is that he tweeted the tweet. He walked the walk. He talked the talk.
Yeah, he's a good operator.
And people loved him. He duchessed. So really, a big factor in chairing or being the MD of the ABC is to spruik, to have good PR and to inspire people and to deal with Senate estimates and to play the media game.
So
now, ITA has no problem with that.
Yeah, so therefore, is this are we heading to a perfect result insofar as ITA, here, you know, she's all great at the front, front of house with ITA, and then you have Dave Anderson.
Assuming they that they appoint
ABC,
Dave
the ABC
Anderson.
Person, you know, who's...
Yeah, and Dave would have to be the front runner at the moment. He was number two to Michelle Guthrie. If she got hit by a bus, well, it turned out she did, and now you've got Dave Anderson.
So what do you think?
I think staff would support the idea of him getting the job.
Do you think he's up for the job? Do you think he's good? He's the right candidate?
That's my view, but I don't know who else is out there. But then I was on the board that chose Michelle Guthrie, so who'd listen to me? You know, she looked like quite a good candidate then too, and had a lot of faults, which became apparent. But, you know, I think still we'll only know in about the end of the year what her legacy properly is. But
did you support Michelle Guthrie?
Board confidentiality, but put it this way, the process was smoothly run, you know. There were other candidates, obviously, but at the end of the day, the board, I think, had a uniform view about what they did. But look, the thing about the point about this board is that it does appoint the next managing director, and if Ida Buttrose is on it, you have others on it that really have no media background whatsoever, and have been put through the mill, I guess you could say, in this traumatic period. Yeah, where they've lost both the MD and the chairman. I mean, they're doing, but nonetheless. So what is that board going to do now is the question in terms of appointing a managing director.
Well, and also, just for you, Anne, and Margot and Deirdre, you know, do we have any inkling to know how ITA will think about the next managing director?
Well, I've got to say, I sat in a green room with her a while back when the dramatic week was happening, Michelle Guthrie got the flick. And the comments, the conversation that we had, I was struck by her general support for the ABC, for her sensitivity to the difficult time that it was going through. It harks back to what Deirdre was referring to, that the greatest challenge is digital. Now, I'm sure one of the factors over the appointment of Michelle Guthrie was we need somebody that's digital savvy, right? Sure. That was a major, we don't want to have another Fred Hilmer, you know, kind of thing. Well, look what happened to Fairfax.
No,
that's the big spectre that's on everybody's brain, right? Now, Ida is alive to these things, and I remember her listening carefully to points. She was sort of saying, but you know, she wasn't a great speaker, but it seemed to me that Michelle Guthrie was doing blah, 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 blah.
Okay.
So I was struck by the fact that Ida was interested and sensitive to the huge problems that are facing the ABC. It's not... We all know about the problems that have been facing commercial media and stuff like that, but what's not widely discussed is the challenges within that ABC.
So just finally on the ABC, putting aside the personas, is one of the problems the charter, in that it's not fully robust enough, as we've shown in the last year, for these times and for an interfering government?
I don't think it is the charter. I think it's the government that's the problem. Okay. You know, I think the government's malevolent against the ABC, the current government. Don't think there's any argument about that. But
every government falls out of love.
They
with
do,
the
and
it's not just a Liberal.
And government. I think the charter. You know, there are things that should be changed in the charter, but I'm not an advocate of wholesale change unless you really know what the political landscape is, because you might end up with some nasty things in there that Pauline Hanson wants. So, you know, let sleeping dogs lie is my suggestion at the moment. It's not the charter, it's the way governments are punitive over funding that is the real problem.
Well, so, okay, a superstar like ITA, back to the person, I guess, but is she going to be great at getting funds out of the government? I mean, we don't really know, do we? But
no, we don't know, but she has got charm and panache.
Yes.
She'll be able to get into any politician's office, you know. ITA's here to see you. That'll be a
good
calling
card. No problem with name recognition.
I think that she's got media experience. She's got television experience, which none of the other people did. And just remember, this is where all the money gets spent. Like, the lion's share of the budget is consumed by TV. So I think she'll bring a lot to the board. The question mark I have about her is I haven't ever seen her stand up on a big media issue and fight for it. Now, maybe that's my ignorance, I'm hoping that she will prove to be a charming, solid advocate for the ABC who's not afraid of taking them on.
She has had fights, though, hasn't she? She has, with Kerry Packer and with all sorts of people.
And fighting for the rights of the aged. Yeah. So even back in the 70s, you know, she was prepared to fight.
For it. Did I mention her father?
Is that a minus?
No, I'm just saying, to Anne's point, I think she's possibly more pragmatic than someone who would make a grandstand.
Peter, I don't think I mentioned her father, did I?
Let's mention her father.
Yes. Well, according to somebody I was speaking to last night, I'd sort of had a vague memory of this, but her father, Charles, was actually a senior executive in ABC News for quite some time. And according to somebody who knew the family, Ida grew up with that in her blood, basically.
Right. Would be the time of Duck Mountain or something.
Well, yeah, it was, yeah. Long time. Well, that's right. Well, Duck Mountain was there for God knows how many years.
That was a lucky guess. Yeah.
But anyway, the point is, you know, she may not have worked at the ABC herself, but it was in her family history for sure.
Okay. Oh, well, time will tell, right? Time will tell. I mean, I think it is a strange turn of events that the chair is not part of the selection panel. I mean, that's the thing, putting aside the personas.
And I spoke to a former board member yesterday who said that selection process, it's enshrined in the Act that they have to have the process, but the Act doesn't say they have to abide by the result, which seems ridiculous, and that the whole process would have cost more north of $200,000, which is, when you add in the amount of money they're about to pay out to Michelle Guthrie, is a big whack of money.
It's a few journos worth.
Yeah.
You know, these
and you can go back to these search firms and say, we want you to look a bit broader, or we want to tweak the search. A lot of it would depend on what public servant wrote the qualities of the chair that they wanted. You know, if it was very restrictive, then that's the sort of list they get. But you can go back and say, give us some more people if you don't like it.
Well, the answer wasn't Greg Hywood anyway, was it?
No.
No. Well, we won't go there. We'll go there another show, another time when Greg pops his head up. Let's go back to the law. So this journalism caper seems a bit hard. We all know it's not the golden age of journalism in terms of how much money we're all making, what have you. But it is the golden age of defamation, or so it seems. It seems that that's the place to make plenty of dough. Steady work. Everyone's a winner. Yeah. So I don't want to get too glib and jaundiced about it. And there are many high-profile cases, some of which we're not going to talk about, some of which we can. And one of the ones we can talk about is the last week's decision of Chow Chak Wang against the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, which is going to cost $280,000 plus costs, although it will be appealed. So I think that brought up a really interesting question around the defence of qualified privilege. So we're going to get a bit lawyerly here, but fortunately we have multiple lawyers in the room, so it's all good. So Justice Wigney rejected the Herald's defence of qualified privilege relating to publications in the public interest. To get that defence, the publishers had to prove that Garneau took reasonable steps to establish the story was right and in the public interest. But Wigney said the journalist, quote, had adopted a, quote, sneering and deprecating tone and basically did him in. And so now the Age and the SMH are standing by Garneau and will be appealing. And in a statement, they said that John Garneau is a careful, meticulous, Walkley Award-winning journalist who is globally recognised for his China expertise. And, quote, we source and check all our stories vigorously and take great pride in our role to inform the community debate. So is Fairfax on the wrong end of this losing battle? And is there something terribly wrong with this, you know, with the way we're approaching defamation in this country again in the digital age?
Having fallen foul of the qualified privilege defence myself, it's a very hard defence to get up. And the idea behind it is that you do everything you possibly can, you act reasonably, but you still might have have fallen short of being able to prove the truth of something.
Mm.
So in this case, the weird thing is that the judge agreed that the unindicted co-conspirator in the UN bribery case was probably Chow Chak Wing. Mm. That was probably who they were referring to. But what he said was, well, Garneau painted it as if he was actually convicted, not was the conspirator, not that he was alleged to be the conspirator.
So it was overwritten. Is that basically what Wigney said?
Yeah, he just went a bit too far. Now, I happen to know quite a lot about this case because I worked at the ABC when we did the same program on Chinese influence.
They're coming up. another coming up this week or next week. Anyway, we'll go.
I know a little bit about it. And the problem everybody has is short of going and actually doing the same investigation as the cops did in America, how do you get beyond, what they've got in their indictment? And so I think, John really tried to do that, but it's an imperfect science. And I know everybody checked everything as thoroughly as they could, but you just can't prove the truth of him being the person who paid the bribe. That's what the FBI is trying to do.
Sure. So the show was broadcast knowing that the defence of the show was going to have to be qualified privilege.
Yes.
Right? Yeah,
yes.
That would have been conscious when you went to air.
And I don't think anyone has succeeded on the qualified privilege defence for many, many years.
So that brings... in the UK, it's a bit simpler, right? I mean, I'm not a super expert on the UK law, but as I understand it, it's basically you'd have to show that it was in the public interest, in the public benefit to get a qualified privilege. So is that what needs to happen here?
And it's certainly simpler in the US as well, where they have a public interest, a public figure defence, so that, something like this would probably be okay in the US, but it's not okay here. So I don't know enough about the British law to say whether we need to revise our laws, but we're certainly... It's certainly... You'd be a very brave journalist to rely on.
So let's boil this down, Deirdre. Are our defamation laws hindering the search for truth?
Well, I think they are because they were drawn up at a time when the media was powerful and wealthy. Mm. There weren't many of them, and they were the chief disseminators of the information in the community. So they had a lot of weight to throw around, and I think the defamation laws were aimed at protecting people against that might. Mm-hmm. Now we have a situation where the media is more and more impoverished, it's more diffuse. Each of them has a smaller share of the community's mind. And at the same time, you've got very powerful forces coming up, whether they're billionaires or industries or powerful companies, who know that they can take out an action, not just on behalf of themselves, but perhaps as a cautioning tale on behalf of their industry or their community or whoever. Say, well, you guys are going to talk about this. We're going to slap you with, a writ, and then we'll do another one and another one. Mm. And you can see it already in the media. They're going, well, we can't take on this person.
Mm.
Or if we're going to take him on, let's make sure we're lawyered up to the gunnels.
Can't do this job. Margot, Peter Grester and others, but Peter Grester has been the front of it, is saying we need a new freedom of speech law, in effect, to protect the right of journalists to do their job. Is that where we're at?
Absolutely. I know there's been a Senate inquiry into the future of public interest journalism, and they're making a lot of recommendations about defamation law reform. And if you speak to journalists like Kate McClymont, you hear that it's almost impossible to get stories like Me Too up in Australia. We've had one, and that's gone to court. And in America, to the ludicrous situation where someone in America was able to write a story about someone who's been a plaintiff in the Australian courts for defamation, and that's been allowable, but in Australia it's not, which is absolutely ridiculous. And I think Anne's point about the public figure defence is right, because under that defence, I mean, obviously it's enshrined in the US Constitution, the freedom of speech. We don't have that, and we should. Is that you can't get damages for defamatory falsehood if it's made, unless it's made with malice. And malice is if you knew something was wrong or you should have known it was wrong. And I think, the Chow Chak Wing case, obviously, that there's no malice there. That was an accident, and that was a tiny error in an otherwise correct case, it seems to me. And I think that really they should be able to defend it on those grounds.
Well, the judge, bringing you back, Matt, took great exception to the tone of the story, which is a very subjective thing. I mean, to Anne's point, maybe it was overwritten a tad, maybe a little bit too definitive, maybe one might say, but nonetheless. The judge should talk about the tone?
One does get the impression that judges have their opinions about the media too, and occasionally their views intrude into their judgments more than they might.
Well, indeed. they're not the paragons of wisdom and virtue that perhaps we...
No, well, to go back to the the old media when it was powerful and now it isn't. But it's always been a historical truth that judges have despised the media by and large because they've regarded it I'm generalising wildly here, but it's still seen as an anti-conservative force, I guess you'd
put
it.
For the state. Yeah. I should add that Justice Michael Wigney is a fine person and we're not defaming him.
No, that's right. I wasn't talking personally about this judgment either.
No, of course not. No, sir. Okay, let's move on. News today, in fact, The Age, has been ordered to pay $180,000 in damages to one of its former journalists for psychological injuries incurred while working as a crime reporter. The journalist hasn't been named, but she worked for The Age from 2003 to 2013, so I probably can all guess who she is. But she covered the gangland wars that gripped Melbourne, and she went to numerous crime scenes. She won many awards, and apparently she went to 32 murder scenes. So this is a really interesting turn of events. I mean, I'm in two minds about it. But clearly, if she's got PTSD, then that's a terrible thing. But now she successfully sued The Age. What do you think, Deirdre?
Well, the implications of the damages is that The Age did something wrong there.
It failed to look after the journal.
Yeah. But I would suppose that if you're a war correspondent or a crime reporter, to do your job, you're going to be exposed to that stuff. And there's no way to protect someone if they're going to be doing that job. And you put up your hand to do that job. It's not that she ran into it when she was training on a regular training thing that you have to do to be a journalist. She put up a hand for the job, or she accepted the job. Therefore, I don't see how you could go through that job and not, or any job in journalism probably, and not be traumatised on the odd occasion. She's obviously been traumatised a lot, but...
Well, it's a tricky one because we haven't read the judgment, and so
we don't know the details.
It does seem, according to the Diet Centre, which has been very active in this country, and some of us have had to do with it over the years, this is the first of its kind. So this is potentially a precedent.
There was a first of its kind with DART, a while back, over post-traumatic stress after covering wars. So you don't know. People do experience a lot of ill effects from being exposed to things that you don't really know about until a while later.
I suspect, Peter, you would find if you started digging that there would be various journalists who've been paid out quietly, not having had to take it to court, because they... Well,
I'm sure that's true.
So I'm thinking about, war correspondents who've gone or... they've been given a soft job somewhere or whatever. Mm. That's how the media's handled it.
To talk about DART too, the point is, and it probably does apply in this case, who knows, but it's how people's employer deals with it in this day and age. So there may well have been pleas for help and, there might have been all sorts of circumstances that the employer didn't react to
We don't, as you say, we don't really know what the ins and outs were. But Margot, one of the ways of looking at this, of course, is that, as we all know, journalists are doing more work, turning over stories more frequently, now in the digital age, you feed the beast. Maybe this is just a sign of things to come.
Maybe it is. I've just finished reading the biography of Marie Colvin. And she clearly had PTSD, but she self-medicated.
She was sort of addicted to it, though.
Yeah, she was addicted to it and she medicated with alcohol and God knows what. I think, it just goes with the job. And, it's a workplace health and safety issue. It's just going to be a cost that's going to be built into media organisations or their insurance contracts.
But the point that we're all making really is that it's being a journalist is bad for your health.
Being a journalist is bad for your health, but that's why we have journalists, right? Someone has to go and bear witness.
Yeah.
Right. No, but that's what I mean. It comes with the job.
It doesn't mean that your employer can just sort of absolve themselves from taking responsibility for you. So when I was at Fairfax, we all went off to the tsunami and I went having no experience covering those sort of things. Mm. When we got back, we were sent off to the psychiatrist or the psychologist. We had to go to two or three sessions. They sort of checked up that we were okay. I probably wasn't at that great risk because it was like a one-off thing and I tended to do business and, you know, have people yell at me down the phone from in that's investigations. Traumatic. Well, that is traumatic.
That's traumatic.
But not as traumatic as seeing dead bodies. True. And I really don't think Fairfax had a very good system for dealing with the people who are day-to-day exposed to it. They've got better because everyone's really aware of it. But in the old days, people were just sent off and, you know, it was a badge of honour that you've been to 47 murders.
Indeed, and went to the pub afterwards and drank yourself stupid.
Yeah.
And one other element to this, I think, is I think this came out in this case, was the journalist was concerned about saying too much about it because everyone else was getting made redundant and she didn't want to be made redundant, so she was concerned about complaining.
Mm.
So but that is another factor, right?
Employers aren't mind readers.
No.
You know,
you have to speak up.
Well, I think she did. But anyway, look, as I say, I haven't read the ins and outs of this case.
But also with PTSD, one incident can do it for you. Absolutely. So you can have a, you know, occupational health and safety program of checking on people, but it's something that it's almost virtually impossible to stop. And AMBOs and police go through the same thing. So maybe we should... They haven't got terribly good systems in place either, but maybe we should be included in those sort of industries looking at ways of helping people cope with terrible events in life.
Anyway, on balance, you'd have to say it's probably a good result because it puts a lot more weight now in the employer's hands. Yeah. They are going to treat it seriously because they're going to have lawyers clambering all over them if they don't.
So. Well, if Justice Michael Wigney don't get your attention, the PTSD case will. Fair enough. And I should say, this is about all the time we've had for this week, but if any of this discussion we've just had causes anyone stress, the lifeline...
Don't sue.
Don't sue. Well, sue Matt Peacock, but the lifeline number is 13 11 14. It's been a great discussion. I could probably speak for another 2 hours.
But my parking meter's out there.
But yeah, you've all got parking meters. So I'd like to thank Deirdre Macken. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I hope you don't get a parking ticket.
So
Margot Seville, thank you so much.
Thanks, Peter.
Anne Davies, thank you. And thank you. A slightly late arrival, but nonetheless, made a contribution. Matt Peacock, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Make sure you subscribe to The Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear us talk about media and politics and a few things in between at your leisure. We'll be back with more next week. But in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is Fourth Estate AU. My name is Peter Frey, and thank you so much for listening.